Welcome to Rocket Talk, the Tor.com podcast. You know me. I'm Justin Landon, your host. I'm still recovering from Worldcon in London, and I figured it was worth doing something of a debrief of events. So I invited two of my fellow bloggers to join me. Foz Meadows is the author of two novels, Solace and Grief and The Key to Starvelt. She reviews for A Dribble of Ink and Strange Horizons and has seen her work appear on Huffington Post, The Mary Sue, and Blackgate. She was nominated for a Hugo for Best Fan Writer in 2013. Welcome, Foz.
Thank you. Hello.
My other guest is Aidan Mower, editor of A Dribble of Ink, where he spends his time commissioning some of the best essays in the field, and he writes a little bit himself as well. He tends to be rather long-winded, which is great. He was nominated for a Hugo for Best Fanzine in 2013 and subsequently won. Welcome, Aidan, and congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, I think Foz and I are very curious to know when we're going to get our piece of your rocket as regular contributors at A Dribble of Ink.
Well, I don't even have my rocket right now. It's somewhere between London and my home here in Victoria. So when it arrives, I can work something out for you.
That's fair. I mean, the odds of you dropping it at some point and, you know, little pieces breaking off are probably pretty high. So if that happens, you know, I hope it doesn't, but if it does, maybe one of the pieces that breaks.
We work out a percentage arrangement.
Yeah.
Well, sounds good. We'll talk after the show.
Obviously, I lost and Foz, you lost as well. So we can commiserate in our losing, but Jared and I were joking that if we won, we were definitely gonna carve up one of our pieces for all of our contributors. It was going to be his rocket, not mine, obviously.
I don't honestly feel like I lost. The slate was so good. Whoever won in my category, I was honestly just going to be stoked, and I was.
Yeah, it's funny. There were a couple of categories, actually both the categories that you two were nominated in, where I really couldn't remember who I voted for. I mean, I was very invested in it, but I couldn't remember because I think I had such a hard time picking.
Yeah, it was like that at times.
Yeah. I think a lot of the down ballot was like that for me. There were, like you, Justin, I can't even really remember the order that I sort of ranked things in on my ballot, but it was just top to bottom. Some of those categories were tough to decide upon.
I think you know what you put at the top of your ballot for fanzine, but I won't make you comment.
No award.
All right, so we're going to kind of just go over Worldcon in general, but I think we should start at the end since that's kind of the most exciting bit, which is the Hugo Awards. And for those who don't know, the Hugo Awards are on Sunday as the convention is kind of winding down. Foz, what were your impressions of the Hugo Awards? Not necessarily the results. We'll get into those in just a minute, but kind of like the ceremony itself.
Well, it was really interesting because the only other Worldcon I have been to before was AussieCon 4 in Melbourne in 2010. And I was really, really new to the whole sort of fandom, being a vaguely professional person within SFF at the time. And I was a little bit starstruck and alternately on the outside of it because there were a lot of the things I didn't really understand. I hadn't really encountered the Hugos much as a thing before then. And in the years since then, it's something I've followed along with, but it's never really been... I don't know what it was about this particular year, if it was just that I was there and I was nominated, or if it was something else, if it was some combination of politics surrounding it beforehand, or if it was just a really good vibe on the night. But I just sat there feeling emotionally invested in the whole thing. Like every single category, I just felt invested in the outcome of every single category. And I know that there'd been the whole brouhaha originally about Jonathan Ross hosting, and I think I saw a couple of tweets to the effect of going, oh, people saying, oh, we should have had Jonathan Ross hosting, but I honestly didn't care. I just felt that it was this wonderful, really great night, and there was a wonderful positive energy in the room, and it was an awards ceremony, which by definition should have been at least partially boring some of the time, but I was just gripped the whole way through, and I just felt really connected to the speeches and everything. I just thought it was a wonderful, wonderful night.
What about you, Aidan?
So this Worldcon was my first. It's the biggest convention that I've ever actually been to. So the whole experience itself was kind of surreal. You know, walking through the convention center, I was sort of amazed just to see these people, you know, who I respect, enjoy their books, enjoy their work as editors, kind of walking down the hall, you know, maybe in groups, you know, maybe on their own and saying hi to them. That alone was something, I'd never experienced before. And then going to the actual ceremony and sitting there among the nominees, I sort of thought, to myself, you know, that was probably it. Like, that was, you know, this was the highlight of the trip. I'm sitting here beside, you know, some of these amazing people, Mary Robinette Kowal and some of the other nominees, Charlie Strauss. And that was, I had a hard time kind of taking all of that in. Like, here I am. I'm actually at the Hugo Awards, at the ceremony and trying my best to enjoy it, without sort of feeling overwhelmed by the amount of energy and kind of passion and, and I don't know how else to put it, but kind of the high energy of the room. It was really neat. It was really special.
Yeah, Foz, you made an interesting point there about mentioning Jonathan Ross. And, you know, Jeff Ryman and Justina Robeson did a commendable job of kind of moving the ceremony along. The show itself, right, the award show itself, at least for me, and it sounds like for both of you, it didn't matter. You know,
it wasn't so much that it didn't matter. It was just, I often feel with award shows that there's this, it's sort of that Monty Python moment of, yes, get on with it, you know, just stop filling it up with patter. And that can be really, the patter can be really enjoyable when it's, you know, when it's somebody who's on form. But I think there was so much investment that particular night in the ballot that even if you had had someone like Jonathan Ross, sans controversy, coming in, making a really good show of it, to a certain extent, the room, there would have been an impatience to just get on with it and just see who'd won. And I think in that sense that having the hosts that we did have, who did, as you say, a commendable job, really helped with the atmosphere. And so the point where they did have the one game at the end of Mort playing Mornington Crescent just before Anne Leckie's win was announced, that seemed to work quite well, I thought, because it was just this one little teaser and then we all went for it.
I do feel like the game of Mornington Crescent really went over the heads of the United States population, or was that just me?
I still have no idea what was going on during that portion of the show. It was amusing, I suppose, but yeah, it seemed very lung concentric to me. Really, yeah. To me, well, as a Canadian.
I think I think there was something slightly delightful about that for me, being an Australian living in the UK, is that so much stuff that you do get inundated with in fandom and with wider culture as well is American centric, and you just sort of have to adapt to, you know, North American jokes and references that you don't get, and you have to try and figure out what this particular brand is and why it's funny that it's being referenced. So it's like, yes, for once you will suffer our peculiarities and be forced to sit there and be momentarily confused while looking like you know what you're talking about.
I like it. So one of the things I noticed as we were watching the event was, unfortunately, there were a lot of people that won that weren't able to be present. And we've talked a lot about some of the various speeches that were given, and Aiden's in particular was memorable. John Chu's was very memorable. The other two most memorable speeches of the night were given as proxy from Kate Elliott, who was there to accept awards, I think, for Cameron Hurley and for Julie Dillon, right? How interesting it was to hear somebody else read somebody else's words. It would have been very cool to have seen Cameron give that speech herself.
Yeah, that would have been quite lovely, I think. But at the same time, part of me was also thinking, because they had said in the bulletin that went out to the, I don't know if you guys remember this, if you read it, but in the bulletin that went out to Hugo nominees just before the convention, when it was talking about speeches, to not bring politics into it. And I sort of remember reading at the time going, yeah, good luck. Good luck with that. That's an optimistic assertion. But I sort of felt, particularly with Cameron's speeches, which were fantastic, just the fact that she'd written them down and given them to other people to deliver, I thought there was a level on which anyone hearing that and going, oh, wow, politics, is this meant to be happening, could have gone, well, she's not there. It's delivered by proxy. So, and somehow that making it, I don't know, easier or more difficult. I don't know, but that was something that occurred to me at the time. But I really enjoyed hearing them, and I thought they were very appropriate and great.
I think also I was the first person that evening to actually accept an award for themselves. And when they announced the Dribble of Ink winning the Hugo, my mind sort of just melted and reality shifted. And going up on that stage and reading that speech was thrilling. It was difficult as well. I don't actually remember reading the speech. I haven't watched the ceremony back, so I don't know how I did. But having somebody deliver a speech by proxy does remove a bit of that dissonance of, like, your mind's kind of going crazy and you're up there sort of trying to be eloquent, trying to be clever, trying to deliver a speech with some impact. And so having a proxy there maybe allows the words of the speech to come through a little more clearly, if not the emotion necessarily.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the results. And we'll start with you, Aiden. And I'd be curious to know if there's any categories that stuck out for you as surprising winners, perhaps?
Surprising winners? Not really, to be honest. There were certainly categories such as the Campbell in particular, which isn't a Hugo, which I had, you know, absolutely no idea who was going to win. Same with fan writer. I felt like any of the five fan writers could have won. So those were a surprise, you know, sitting in the audience because I didn't have that idea. I wasn't able to guess. In terms of categories, yeah, Game of Thrones, beating out Doctor Who was impressive, I suppose. And yeah, I don't know. I'm just looking at the list now. I was certain Saga was going to win Best Graphic Story, but to see Time by Randall Munroe win was a nice, pleasant surprise as well. So otherwise, I feel like I was pretty happy across the board with all of the winners, and wasn't really shocked by anything other than my category.
What about you, Foz? Do you see anything that kind of surprised you?
Not surprised. I mean, as we've said before, there were so many good entries in so many categories that it was sort of a question of, oh, well, this thing that I voted first, I think, didn't win. But this other thing that I really liked won. I think the only two categories where I sort of went, oh, that's still a good outcome, but I would have slightly preferred X, is I would have really liked Orphan Black to win for Best Short Form, because I just think that show is amazing and all the awards should go to it. But at the same time, I still like Game of Thrones. And as Aiden just said, it was nice to have something beat out Doctor Who, just because it always seems to win and I'm a bit disenchanted with it at the moment. But again, had the five-ish Doctors won because I thought that was sweet and hysterical, I would have been happy as well. And the other one was the Not a Hugo Campbell Award. I would have really liked Benjinoon Sudeunkyu to win because I just think her writing is astonishing and amazing. But again, it was a category where she was up against a whole slate of other people whose writing I also really, really, really love. So it was just a night of, you couldn't really feel disappointed about any of the winners, I think. I don't remember feeling disappointed just so much. Oh, this person didn't win, but another person I really liked won. Let's all win together. Everybody gets an award.
One category I'd quickly like to talk about as a nice surprise was Best Fan Artist, Sarah Webb. I think she's 19 years old, and she just crushed the category. She won in one pass. We probably don't have time to go into Hugo voting math, but she crushed that category as a 19-year-old fan artist, and her work is tremendous. And I was so happy to see that happen.
And I think that's particularly with all of the guff that gets put around at the moment about, oh, fake geek girls and, you know, lots of sometimes subtle, but sometimes not very subtle at all, sometimes quite overt, in fact, ways of shaming particularly young and teenage girls in fandom. It was just like, yes, you can all shut up now. I mean, you should have shut up in the first place, but it was just a really nice, powerful moment against that. And I mean, it was so well deserved as well because her work is gorgeous.
Yeah, I would just point out, if you pull up all those fan artists and you put her work next to the other four nominees, I mean, it's very clear that Sarah Webb will have a career in illustration. She's already been published in Writers of the Future. She illustrated the story that Megan O'Keefe won Writers of the Future for in that book. And her work is obviously of extremely high quality. I mean, she will illustrate covers in the future, I'm sure. The rest of that category is deeply entrenched in sort of the fan artist fandom, I think, which kind of interesting. Yeah. And to speak to the winning in one pass, right? She got, I think, 831 first place votes. If you have, over 50% first place votes, you win. And that's what she did. So, that did not happen anywhere else on the ballot. I'll point out that was the only category where somebody won. Just based on their first place votes. And, Foz, your comment about Orphan Black is interesting because, I don't know if a lot of people have noticed this, but Orphan Black actually got the second most first place votes in the short form category. Game of Thrones got the most with 744, but Orphan Black got 630, and Doctor Who, Day of the Doctor, got 539. The reason Doctor Who finished second, though, is because all the other Doctor Whos, believe it or not, put Doctor Who second. So,
well, it was a nice moment at the Hugo after party, when I think George Martin said to Will Pascoe, who was there to collect for Orphan Black, had it won, saying, you know, thank you guys, you know, it was your votes that put us over the top, essentially. And good to see it rank so highly with the second place, you know what I mean, second of the first place votes. But I just love that show. I love it to pieces.
I think Martin was right on that. I mean, I think he knows how the Hugo voting works pretty well. He's been on that damn thing enough times.
Keeper of the Hugo Lewis's ribbon, so.
Which I did not get one.
George Martin literally refused to give me one because I had something a little shinier, which, you know, I'll take it.
So as I was looking over the ballot, nothing really surprised me either, except that I guessed wrong in almost every category that I was trying to handicap. You know, as the awards were read, I was sitting next to Jared Schern from Porno Kitchen and my co-editor of our book that was nominated, and every time I'd lean over to him and I'd whisper who I think was going to win, and I was wrong almost every single time. And I think I was wrong because I greatly overestimated the impact of the UK ballot. So I had really thought that the UK was going to have a great deal of influence on who won, and so I was often picking people that I thought the UK population was going to vote for. So I picked Abigail. I thought Abigail was going to win for Fan Writer. I think I picked T in Jeopardy for Fancast. I thought Porno Kitch would win in Fanzine. It turned out that not only did that not come true, in many cases, didn't even seem like those British intellectual properties got any kind of bump, which really surprised me.
Yeah, when you put it like that, I mean, particularly with Doctor Who losing out, it's interesting. But I mean, then again, and this is something I heard several people say over the course of the convention, it wasn't so much that it was just a British bump. It was a very much a world con in the sense of people from other countries. And I think it's just that London being perhaps more accessible in the sense of to people from Europe and people from other countries, more so than America, which is, I think, frankly, terrifying to try and enter from anywhere else in the world for any reason. It was a very international convention. And so I think a lot of that bump of non-Americanness, I think, is the better way of putting it, rather than a bump of just Britishness spread out over different places, different properties.
I sort of agree. Over the course of the weekend, I met people from so many different countries that the actual kind of British contingent at LungCon didn't seem even unusually high. And I think, you know, the high voter numbers this year, high nominator numbers, high attendee numbers, sort of made up for any bump that the sort of British crowd might have given to any particular entity on the ballot.
I think that provides a nice segue to talking about WorldCon at large, but I'm not going to use it yet. I'm just going to put it aside for one second because there is one other thing on the ballot that I want to talk about. And it was, to me, the biggest surprise of the night. The Wheel of Time finished fourth in best.
Oh, nine. Wow. I didn't even look at the stats for that. I just was too busy cheering for Anne Leckie.
What's fascinating about it is that it got, you know, Ancillary Justice cleaned house. I mean, Ancillary Justice got 1,335 first place votes, which was only a couple hundred votes away from sweeping the category. But Wheel of Time got the second most with 658. But if you look at the way the ballot functioned, as the different passes went through, the Wheel of Time picked up very few additional votes from any other books, with the exception of Warbound, where it picked up a fair chunk. But it was interesting that most of the people that voted in this that weren't voting for Wheel of Time put Wheel of Time last. They had no interest in awarding it, seemingly, a best novel award. That surprised me. Does that surprise you to learn, Foz?
I don't know if it surprises me exactly. I mean, so I only ever read the first book of Wheel of Time in high school, and I liked parts of it, disliked others, was ambivalent towards others. Again, tried to start the third one, and the very first page was a whole new quest for a whole new MacGuffin that had never been mentioned in the first book, and I was like, I am getting right the hell off this crazy train now, because this thing is already like 9 books long and not finished, and I'm just not going there. And I maintain, in retrospect, that was a solid life decision on my part. But I just adored Ancillary Justice, and I just honestly didn't know, because there'd been so much discussion about Wheel of Time that I'd sort of been feeling it was, I think a lot of us had a feeling that it was a two horse race and that, you know, Wheel of Time was going to pull ahead. And I remember sort of sitting there thinking, oh, please be Ancillary Justice, please be Ancillary Justice. And it was just that beautiful, perfect sort of biopic fandom moment where literally the entire auditorium of 4,000 people stood up and gave a standing ovation. As Anne Leckie went down to collect the award, and it was just this beautiful moment.
What about you, Aiden? Does it surprise you?
I also thought it was going to be a two-horse race between Ancillary Justice and Wheel of Time. It doesn't surprise me, though, that Wheel of Time fell off as through the later rounds of voting. I think people were either, you know, it was sort of binary in that people were either fully on board with this idea of Wheel of Time winning a Hugo or sort of fully against it. So you either put it on your ballot first or you leave it off or put it after no award. So I'm not surprised that, you know, Ancillary Justice came through like a freight train, as it should, as it has in most other awards. And, you know, Wheel of Time doing what it did, you know, I can see that, you know, it probably had that small, passionate contingent who was putting it first on the ballot, but then other people were kind of looking more holistically at the novels there. I have immense respect for Wheel of Time. I have bounced off the eighth book multiple times, and I just can't get through that middle portion of it. I was, you know, so I was sort of amused to see it on the ballot. I do think that it, you know, its impact on the genre for good and ill, but widespread regardless. It's interesting, an interesting idea to reward that. I think it was the right decision, though, to give it to Anne's novel, which was fantastic.
I think the one thing I would add just quickly on the subject of Wheel of Time being nominated was I think it alerted a lot of us to that particular quirk in the rules of the Hugo Awards, that if no book within a series has been nominated for a Hugo previously, then the entire series can be nominated as a whole in the year of the completion of the final volume. And certainly that's something that I've often thought before, particularly when it comes to series that I love, like, for instance, the works of Kate Elliott and Catherine Kerr, where I think, why do these books not have awards? And I often think that's a problem with series in fantasy circles, is that we tend to nominate single work books or first volumes, and they tend to be the ones that win awards, because you can't really try to nominate like book five of a series for something. It's always a bit, you know, you either sort of nominate the whole or you nominate the first. And it can be this difficult process, but I would be really interested to see if next year or in future years we see more nominations that take advantage of that rule, because there are certainly some series that are coming to a completion that I would love to nominate in that category on the basis of that rule, so that it's sort of as a holistic thing.
Yeah, I actually like it. There's an author in particular that comes to mind when I think about this rule, and it's Steven Erikson and his Malazan Book of the Fallen, where the first book is really not very good. The series as a whole, I think, is incredible. And so I think that actually happens fairly frequently, especially in very long series that are 10 books or 8 books or whatever, that the first book can often be the weakest book because it's the author's first book. It's the author still finding his, you know, his or her voice. And so providing this outlet, I think, is really cool, particularly because in this genre, we are incredibly guilty of first books providing no meaningful conclusion.
So true.
It drives me nuts. The other thing about the results that I'd be curious to get your comments on, Foz and Aiden's as well, is we all know about the Sad Puppy ballot that was out there. Vox Day put a ballot out there, a slate. He called it the Sad Puppy slate, that was going to nominate and then vote in the Hugos. And we were going to show those progressive lefty weirdos how lame their voting process is, or how lame the Hugo is. And if you look at the stats, this is the great thing about the Hugos, is we get the data. And it's like the only thing in publishing where we actually get the data. And we see that Vox Day's novelette was nominated 69 times. We'll call it 70 for math ease. And after all of this fear that these voters could have a major impact on the ballot, I think seeing that the person who perpetrated it only got 70 nominations can kind of make us look back on it and laugh a little bit.
Well, yes and no, because I think it was similar with a similar thing with the SFWA when he was nominated to be president of that a while ago, and I think somebody ran the numbers on that afterwards, and it turned out there was really only sort of 7 or 8. There'd been some sort of really sort of violent agitation with people putting up complaints, and it turned out there were really only sort of 7 or 8 key agitators. And, you know, the ones who were sort of really responsible for a lot of the awful stuff that was being said. And I think on the one hand, yes, when you, there is something very comforting in looking at the raw numbers and going, this is a minority, a demonstrable minority of people who think that this is a wonderful idea to support this guy and the appalling things that he says. But on the other hand, there is also a lot of, there is tacit support, and it's that sort of slow institutional thing that can be hard to shift. I don't know if I'm making myself very clear here, but I mean, if you ever, and I don't recommend this as a decision, but if you ever do stumble onto his blog and look at the number of commenters, the fact that you can, and I think we know overall that when you look at the number of people who vote in the Hugo Awards, because it is specifically people who can afford to attend the convention or who can afford to pay for a membership, and even then, not everyone who does that, who pays to attend the convention, votes in the awards. There is always this sort of lurking uncertainty of, okay, these are the people who cared enough to actually vote, but what about all of the silent other people who didn't vote? Where do they sit? And I think that's what can make it still somewhat less of a funny thing. Like, we can sort of look at it and go, yay, there aren't as many raging sexist, racist, horrible people as we thought, but at the same time, it's not like everybody's walking around with their badge on, with a badge on their head, telling us what they really think. And that can be a little unsettling at times, to think that there is perhaps tacit support that you don't, that isn't visible, but which is nonetheless felt at times.
I think by its very nature, the internet gives loud voices to small groups, and that can be used for good, and it can also be used for ill. And I think that it just makes, it makes messages like that maybe seem a little larger than they are. In the end, the Sad Puppy campaign, it was effective in getting names on the ballot, because that's a little transparent. Nobody knows what's going to be on the ballot until it shows up. But as soon as that ballot came out, fandom sort of galvanized around the idea of making sure that the right people won the awards last Sunday. And no matter how loud that small group of sad puppies was, they couldn't really affect the vote when people were determined to make sure that it came out a different way.
Yeah, I think ultimately the biggest disappointment that will come out, or that should come out of all of the Sad Puppy things, is just the things that got left off the ballot because of this, perhaps. If you look at best novella and best novelette categories, it's possible that the Sad Puppy campaign knocked some things off the ballot that should have been on there, or that would have been on there if not for the campaign. And that's a shame. Let's move on, and let's segue around a little bit from what we were talking about earlier about how international Worldcon was. And wow, it was really international. In fact, I sat in, of course, my own panels that I was on, but additionally panels that I sat in on. I can't tell you how many times there were no questions asked by somebody from the US or the UK, which was amazing to me. Did you guys experience that same thing?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I did quite a lot of stuff, so my head is still decompressing from it all. But I don't recall a particular American, you know, US centrism to any of the questions or questioners. But again, but not being American myself, that's still not my expectation, because I've not been to an American con. Like, I deal with a lot of American politics online, but in person, I'm still just more accustomed to having people from everywhere. I mean, in my personal life, my husband is an academic. We hang out with a lot of academics, which means I'm fairly used to just hanging out with people from a wide range of places, some of whom are American, some of whom are from Australia or all over Europe or other parts of the world. And that's a kind of balance that I felt was familiar, that was represented at Worldcon, is that it didn't feel like everybody was from just the one place.
I sort of had a lot of the same feelings as Foz. I'm also Canadian, so I have a bit of a, you know, North American centrism, I suppose.
I like how you say you're also Canadian. Are you also something else?
I'm also I'm fully Canadian. I'm also not American or British. So, I live in a very multicultural part of the country on the West Coast. So it's something that I have come to expect, sort of in day to day life. And being at Worldcon and seeing that reflected as well was really gratifying for me. I think everybody's kind of heard about how Worldcon is just, you know, for old white dudes. And that wasn't the case at all. It wasn't my experience, at least. And maybe that was the panels I chose to attend and the people I met. But it was, I met and saw such an incredibly diverse range of people, speaking on panels, asking questions, wandering around the fan village, that it, Worldcon in general just sort of, it not just exceeded my expectations in terms of what the crowd would be like, but smashed them, and left them completely behind, which I was really happy about. I'll be curious to see. I'll be in Spokane next year, and I'll be curious to see if they can maintain something similar, being in a smaller location, in America.
Well, so I was at Lone Star Con last year, in Texas, and I had two very contrasting experiences between Lone Star Con and LunCon. And I believe I saw Alistair Reynolds tweet the other day that he had been rapidly losing faith in Worldcon and Worldcon fandom, and that LunCon had restored some semblance of hope for the future of fandom and probably more specifically Worldcon and that convention culture. Foz, you mentioned earlier that you've been to Worldcon in Australia, and given that that one was also out of the United States, was LunCon like that, or was it different?
Difficult to say. I think certainly that, I mean, because Australia is very far away, and I do think that there was still not a US centrism to it, but I mean, there were obviously a lot of Australians, but there were, you know, I think there was a less diverse range of attendees just because for pretty much anyone, Australia is an ass long of a way to go. Like, it is way down the other end of the world, and that is a really long, expensive flight. Whereas just the comparative centrality of London, where you can just sort of hop there and it's a hub. I think that you just did see people going, oh, well, I can actually get there with comparative ease. And so there was just a wider range of people there. But as I said, I mean, I've not ever been to a convention which has been really sort of American heavy. So I suspect if and when I finally do get around to going to a con in America, which I would one day love to do, although the prospect equally terrifies me, I will find that quite of a culture shock at some point.
You may. And one of the things that we always hear people say this, they say fandom is graying. And I hate that term because it is very ageist. It implies that older fandom has some sort of problem. And it's not really so much that fandom is getting older. It's just that fandom in a lot of ways feels like at times in the United States, like it's stopped bringing in new blood. That we have this very staid population of fans who aren't reaching out to new blood. And so we're seeing very little crossover from, you know, sort of like the young adult convention and the Comic-Con convention in the United States. And our sort of science fiction and fantasy cons are becoming increasingly isolated, it feels to me. But that was completely the opposite experience at LunCon. I mean, at LunCon, it felt young. It felt energetic. It felt like people were just excited to be there.
Something that I really loved about the convention was not just the spread of age ranges in the attendees, but just the real sense that families were there. I mean, Kate Elliott was there with her adult daughter. Carrie Vaughan's parents were there with her as well. Aliette de Boddard was there with her baby son and her husband. If you went down into the fan space, you would see kids of all ages, you know, from babies sort of all the way up into teenagers and adults. You just see everybody there. And there was this real sense that it wasn't just, you know, what we sort of term, I don't know, like a traditional family of sort of, you know, parents and kids. It was sort of found families as well, groups of people walking about in all ages who were there as a sort of geek family. And it was this lovely experience of thinking, yes, this is not, I mean, I think when you say that anything is graying, as a group of humans, whether you mean it pejoratively or not. Isn't that just true? People age. We get older. You know, there's always a new generation coming up and always a young, an older one tailing away. That's just life. But I think for some reason it surprises us in fandom because for so many years, this thing that we do with the imagination and the rockets and the lasers and the magic was considered something that we were all meant to grow out of. So there's this kind of astonishment when we go, oh, wow, there's all of these people who were told 50 years ago that they were going to grow out of this who haven't, and they're still here. But that doesn't mean we don't have our own, as you say, staid politics. It doesn't mean we don't have an entropy or a sort of static membership at the top. But there are always new people coming in, and I think, yeah, you're right. This convention was a really good embodiment of that.
It was certainly invigorating for me. I called my wife about halfway through the convention and was excitedly telling her about all the young families that I was seeing around the convention center floor, from, you know, little toddlers to kids in their, you know, 5, 6, 7 who were enjoying the convention. And as soon as she heard that, she sort of became excited about the idea of being able to come to Spokane, to Saskatchewan with me next year. And she's not a huge science fiction and fantasy fan. She's connected to it through me and understands and respects the community. But just hearing about that energetic vibe, that environment where these families are kind of enjoying the experience together was very exciting for her. And so next year I'll be there with my family. I won't be, stag at the convention, and I'm excited for that opportunity to introduce my wife. I'll have a baby with me, who probably won't get too much out of it, but introduce my wife at least to these people that I've met, these friends I made last weekend, and hope, you know, to meet again next year and hopefully show her, you know, why it is that this community is so important to me. And a place like Worldcon or any convention where you can show that off is a perfect entryway, I think, into a community.
Yeah, I've often thought about bringing my family, and my wife has thus far not found that a particularly entrancing option. I mean, the fact that I come home after a convention bleary-eyed and sleep-deprived probably doesn't make her think that she would have, you know, quite the same experience that I have. Although, Mer Lafferty was there, Orbit author and podcast host, was there with her daughter, who I think is 10-ish. And as it turns out, her daughter was on as much programming as Mer was, which I thought was cool. There was an entire, you know, series of children's fandom programming that was built around kids talking to other kids, which I thought was really exciting.
Yeah, I think it's this great thing. And I think, again, part of it is just the internet making stuff like this more available and creating a greater awareness of it. I mean, I think I actually even said this on a panel about fandom at the con, but growing up in Australia, we didn't really have, if you were like me and you liked science fiction fantasy, there weren't as many sort of big conventions or local conventions. And if, you know, the ones that there were, you kind of had to know somebody on the inside, I assume anyway, to get into them, because certainly it wasn't something that you could just Google and think, oh, wow, here's this thing that's on. And you didn't have sort of online communities in the same way that you do now, where people could go, hey, there's going to be a convention in this city. Do you guys want to come and we can meet in person instead of just chatting on the internet all the time? And I think that's something that's really filtering into a lot of these conventions now with, as you say, sort of the YA and the anime and everything contingent, is that you've got people who are using them as a place to meet digital friends. Well, you know, not digital friends, that sounds really weird, but friends from the internet, where you just say, okay, here is a place where we can go to meet in a context of bonding over the shared interests that have allowed us to bond already online, which is fantastic. And I never got to do that when I was a teenager. I would have loved to. I would have, something like this when I was, you know, any time from like 9 to 19, that would have just, I would have been so there, but didn't have the opportunity to go or didn't have the knowledge that this was a thing you could even do. And I was looking around at LongCon and seeing groups of teenagers walking around in sort of flocks. And I was like, oh man, I would have had so much fun here. I would have made such poor life decisions, but it would have been awesome. You know, I would have had the best time. And I still do have the best time. And I get to do that for the rest of my life now, which is great.
Yeah, I would have made some really bad life decisions too as a teenager at a convention.
I probably would have been in a corner reading a book, as sad as that is to say.
But the problem is
a signed book, but a book
at a convention. Aiden, you wouldn't have been left alone in a lot of cases. Oh, you're reading something. I've read that. Let's talk about it.
That's true.
I think that
let's sneak to the bar.
You talk. You, yeah, they'll never card us. This is England. when you talk about these digital friends, or to make it even creepy, call them digi-friends.
Oh god, don't even pick up on my worst phrase of this entire podcast, and just don't do that. Forget I said that.
But I actually think that phenomenon is why a lot of us, and by us I mean the blogging community, decided to attend this convention. I mean, part of it was that we were nominated. But the fact that I was Hugo nominated wasn't going to be enough to get me there. The fact that it was going to be an opportunity for me to meet you, Foz, and Aiden, and Jared Shurin, and Ann Perry, and the book smugglers, and you know, all the other people in the blogging community that we've been talking to for years and years and years and having these great conversations with, that was a huge driver for getting us to attend, I think. Particularly when you start to talk about the cost of going to a convention across the world.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love the thing of going, and then there are people there that you've otherwise spoken to on the internet. And it's this silly thing of wherever you physically live in the world, we have this big mythology in our TV shows and narratives and stuff about having the great group of friends around you. But, I mean, if that happens once, maybe twice in your life, that you have a whole bunch of people who really share your interests and who you really get along with, and they all live within a reasonable distance of you and you're all able to hang out all the time, that is actually a really rare and special thing, and we have such a mythology about it being the default, and it's not. And now we have this ability to make friends with like-minded people online, and, you know, sometimes they live in other countries or other states or just too far away to meet up regularly. And then you go, hey, there's this big convention, the kind of thing where there are other reasons to outlay money to go there. Plus, we get to see each other, and it's brilliant.
Aiden, do you think that the internet in many ways is going to give us some hope that fandom, this in-person fandom, this convention fandom can continue to grow? Because I know a lot of people that sit at home, both writers, bloggers, fans, that sit at home by themselves, go on the internet, and that's their outlet for finding people to talk to about this stuff, and would never go to a convention because, I hear this all the time, I won't know anybody. And nobody likes to go to something alone. It can be a very isolating experience. And it feels like the internet and Twitter in particular, but also blogging communities and forum communities, are giving an opportunity for people to be able to come to these things and not be alone anymore.
I absolutely think that's the case. To begin with, I don't think it's a coincidence that you talk about Worldcon being an opportunity to meet these friends that you've made through kind of the online blogosphere, and also the Hugo nominations, including many of these friends that you've made through the online blogosphere. I think those nominations open the doors for many people in helping them recognize that, oh, hey, this huge international convention, it is for me, because look at this. The book smugglers are on there. I love their stuff. I comment on their blog all the time. Or, oh, Speculative Fiction 2012 is in there. I wrote something that Jared and Justin included. So I think that all of a sudden seeing these nominations out there just was the first indicator that these conventions are maybe much, much bigger, much more inclusive than they had originally appeared or have appeared for the last few years or decades. I did go to Worldcon because I was nominated. I didn't think that I was going to get to go otherwise. It seemed like a big expense to me. And so I was there for the awards ceremony, and I was genuinely afraid that I wouldn't make any friends. I knew I had online friends. I knew you, Justin, and Foz, you'd be there. I knew I'd get to say hi, but I had these, you know, visions in my mind that I'd wander the show floor, I'd see some panels, I'd sort of, you know, see people at a distance having fun and never get to be a part of it. And
I feel like there should be sad violin music in the background.
Yeah, no. And then, you know, a swell of happy violin music, because my experience wasn't, it was you know, anything but that. I made so many good friends, and these people that I knew kind of through the internet already, my digital friends, I immediately fell in beside them as though I'd been, you know, real life meet space friends with them for years. And it was proof to me that that online community is a real thing. It's not just a, you know, a phantom community online that, that, you know, sort of exists nebulously, but that it's a real thing that creates real friendships and real relationships. And I think that conventions are a fantastic counterpart to that.
Yeah, there's no doubt that that's true, because when I met Liz Burke for the first time, I'm pretty sure she broke one of my ribs because the hug was so fierce. And yeah, of course, Liz and I had never met until LunCon. And that's a very exciting thing to have that experience of knowing people that you didn't even know you knew in a lot of ways.
One of my, the highlights of my weekend was, meeting two of my favorite authors, like bar none, period. They were walking down the convention center hall together. And I was nervous to say hi to both of them. It was Elizabeth Baer and Scott Lynch, but they were talking to Kate Elliott, who I had met before, at the convention and know well online. So I saw that as an icebreaker, and I was like, okay, they're talking to Kate. I can go up. I can say hi to Kate and maybe she can introduce me. So I went up, I said hi. They both sort of looked at my name tag, looked up at me, and then initiated a big group hug. So my first encounter in real life, in the real world with Scott Lynch and Elizabeth Baer, was a big group hug. And it was just this surreal moment of realizing that, like, these people, these authors whose work I adore, and as an aspiring writer myself, who I respect dearly, you know, are part of this community themselves, that it's not just sort of a passive thing. It's something that they're excited to be part of too. And it was just very overwhelming, and positive for me to have that experience.
It is like that though, because you're never quite sure what, you know, who's following you, who's reading you online, who's aware of you, and you know who you're aware of, but there's, you know, you can follow so many people on Twitter or Tumblr that you can sort of think, oh, okay, well, it's possible that this person follows me, but they're not actually following, if you know what I mean. Like, they're not keeping up with it. You're just on a list. And then suddenly you encounter them at a convention, they're saying, oh, I've been reading your stuff. I had one of my favorite moments was at the Hugo after party, and Lily Yu, whose work I just think is amazing, I sort of went up to say that to her, and she's like, oh, I've been reading your blog for years. And I was like, yay! And it was this sort of lovely sort of mutual fan-squee moment, which was really touching and lovely, and she was wonderful. And it's this, yeah, you do just get moments like that at conventions where you sort of try to shyly insinuate yourself. You do what you just said, Aiden, where you're sort of like, okay, that person I vaguely know is talking to somebody that I really want to meet, so I'm going to go up and like slyly initiate a conversation and see if they'll introduce me. And you totally do that, but half the time it turns out the person that you want to talk to, you know, if nothing else, knows of you as well, and it just creates this lovely bubble of not quite intimacy, but it's sort of like you're all at a party being introduced by mutual acquaintances and getting a nice drink put in your hand and, hey, come talk to this cool person. And, you know, in my head, that's what conventions are to me. I love it.
There was also the time that I pretended to know somebody to introduce somebody, which was a fantastic experience.
Convention logic.
But you can do that, and that's the great thing about it. Okay, so I've kind of laid the groundwork here about fandom. We've talked about the Hugos. We've talked about fandom. We've talked about how there is sort of different stratas of fandom. And I want to posit something. I've been thinking a lot about fandom since the convention. And I don't see fandom as a monolithic thing. I think there are definitely constituencies within fandom. And I see the part of fandom that is very ingrained in conventions. They're very ingrained with hosting conventions, doing a lot of the work to put the convention on. They're the ones that set up a lot of that participate in a lot of the things at a convention that are not related to the work. The nighttime dance events and the, you know, the daytime activities and there was like at one point a sword fight reenactment on the fan village floor. I mean, these are the sorts of things that a certain percentage of fandom gets into. And then there's the other side, which I find myself on more often, that's more connected to the work itself, that I'm very passionate about the work. I'm not necessarily passionate about quote unquote fandom or the community around fandom. I mean, I love participating, but that's not necessarily what drives me to the community. And as I'm observing this, it's kind of one of the things that I was wondering about, was as we look at the future of fandom and the future of conventions, how do we reconcile these two communities, one who's very passionate about the convention itself and the other ones who are very passionate about using the convention as a means to talk about the things they love?
Well, I don't think it's something that really needs to be reconciled. I mean, we talk about a community, and I mean, if you look at any community, they're always made up of constituent parts. The whole thing's a sort of series of sets of Venn diagrams overlapping of people who belong to one group and the other, and people who belong to this and this and this, and some people just in their discrete spheres. But it all interconnects, it all overlaps. And I think when you sort of come into the middle of the belly of the beast, so to speak, at a convention, you see everybody around you. That can sometimes be sort of not overwhelming, but it can make you aware that there are parts there and people there that you perhaps had not noticed before, or noticed in such numbers or in any other kind of balance or capacity. You know, there's always going to be these different parts of fandom. There's always going to be people who like talking about stuff as opposed to people who like making things. And sometimes those are the same person and sometimes they're different people. And people who just want to build this space for people to come and do the stuff in. It's like any sort of community where you've got people who occupy different roles, and that's how it all functions. You need everybody. And I think the only thing that really stands to be a detriment in that sense is when you get the group of people who decide to police what actually makes you a fan, because you're only doing thing A instead of thing B, C, and D. You know, when you get people sitting on the borders saying, okay, you do this one thing and we think that's less good than, I don't know, something else. I'm being very vague here, but I think you hopefully sort of get what I'm saying, that we have a lot of conversations at the moment about what makes a true fan or what makes a real geek, and it's bullshit. It's complete bullshit. You rock up and you like the thing, or you like being around people who like the thing, or you want to discuss the thing or analyze the thing or build a space for people to talk about the thing in, when maybe having a swing dance off to the side, and it's all cool. It's all beautiful.
I don't really have much to add to what Foz said. I agree mostly that I don't know that those things do need to be reconciled. I think it's important to create conventions that are spaces that allow people to celebrate kind of their fandom or their idea of fandom the way that they want to find like-minded people, and hopefully to engender a little bit of crossover in that. I think LunCon did a great job by introducing the Fan Village, which was a great big place where different groups of fans could meet sort of within the same vicinity of one another, with beer in hand, which always helps social situations, and, you know, hopefully create some of that crossover naturally. And it doesn't have to be a permanent thing, but just, you know, rubbing shoulders with the other side can often help you understand where they're coming from and see the value in what they're celebrating.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that that big open space where you had the gaming tent and the library area and the various bids for the different world cons, and then your literary beers, and then your bar area was all sort of visible to each other, which I think is very healthy. You know, oftentimes at conventions, the different constituencies sort of hide themselves away, but you know, their particular events like aren't necessarily entirely visible. If you don't know where they are or what they are, you don't see them, you don't get a chance to interact with them. And I think the Fan Village made great strides in that. I do think though that there is a place where this conflict that we're talking about is very active and actually happening. And that's to kind of tie it back around to what we started the conversation with, which was the Hugo Awards. The fanzine category continues to be an interesting confluence of different communities. And I remember I was at the Hugo Losers Party and I was looking over the statistics, and a gentleman who's involved with Journey Planet and Banana Wings, whose name I can't recall, started talking about what should have been on the ballot and what should not have been on the ballot. And I don't know that he knew who I was. so it was a different conversation maybe than he would have if he had known who I was. But I thought it's still that fascinating concept of what is and is not a fanzine is sort of in a lot of ways very similar to me to what is and is not a fan. It's this notion that like, this is something not for you, it is for us, that I still really struggle with how to address and how to handle. Because to me, and we, Aiden, you and I have had this conversation a dozen times, like, you know, the fanzines just need to wake up, you know, fandom is going a different direction and it's coming online and they just need to accept it. But that's sort of in contrast, this notion of that there's, you know, that it's all fine.
I've been vocal in the past about the fanzine versus kind of online writing. debate. And in recent years, I don't know if it's that I've cooled a little bit, but what I've actually come to realize is that, again, getting back to the last conversation, is that together, blog writing, or editing a blog, writing online, editing a paper fanzine or a PDF fanzine, they're not really all that different. They channel maybe different things. One might be more focused on sort of fandom itself and analyzing fandom as an entity. And I think, you know, maybe the blogosphere is more interested in analyzing the actual works of science fiction and fantasy. But at the end of the day, they are just, they're fan writing. They're fans getting together to be passionate and to create a community around a mutual love. And I do think that, as proud as I am, obviously, to have won the Hugo for best fanzine, and to see other blogs on the ballot, I do think the ideal is to have a kind of holistic and inclusive, list of nominees. It's not to discount traditional fanzines as sort of being, you know, old and over, or as blogs as being new and cutting edge and doing, you know, the important work. It's that they both occupy a different space that should be rewarded. Fandom's history needs to be rewarded, and the future needs to be rewarded. And it's about, as I said on stage during my speech, it's about giving a voice to anybody who wants one. And whether that's talking about, the, you know, latest happenings at a convention that happened last month, or, you know, debuting cover art and writing snarky comments about it. I think there's a place for all of that in fan writing and fan publishing. And we need to continue to celebrate that and continue to read as widely as we can, and to find the things that interest us, and not draw lines based on the method in which it's published.
The reason that you had this swing towards more digital stuff is just simply because it makes it accessible to a wider range of people in different places where you might otherwise have physical restrictions on who can access a thing. But the question of access isn't what makes the concept worthy in the first place. And I think, particularly when there's a lot of discussions, I mean, I was on a panel about this, about what constitutes a fan category nowadays, when you can have people who are otherwise professional artists or professional authors getting nominated in fan categories for stuff. And I think it's just the base thing. It's what defines a fan is love. It's love for the thing, the fact that even when you're not being paid, or especially if you're not being paid for this particular piece of work, it's you sitting down on your own time to make something, to write something, to say something, to do something, and share it with other people, not in the expectation of reward, but because it's a thing worth sharing. And that's the oldest part of storytelling. It's the oldest part of narrative, is the audience and the call and answer between them, and saying, what do you think about this? Let's talk about the thing that we just told. Let's talk about why it was worth telling and why it's worth telling again and again. That to me is sort of at the heart of fan culture, and whatever medium people want to choose to do that. And I think it's a mistake as well to say that it's purely digital now, because particularly with a lot of things, there's slow movements now as well of people saying, well, we're going to craft something. We're going to take it, you know, we're going to handcraft gorgeous jewelry themed around Doctor Who, or we're going to take knitting patterns and knit scarves for Game of Thrones. You have fan crafts, and that's purely real-world, slow, painstaking, dedicated, skilled fan labor that people do for love. And, you know, sometimes they might sell their stuff, but it's also, let me make you a cool thing to express the fact that we both like it. And I think fanzines, you know, traditional fanzines, I don't see why that should be something that has to die out just because we have the internet. It's everything. It's all these different ways of telling stories. We want, and talking about stories and sharing that we love them. It's more avenues, not less.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that attending a convention has quite softened all of us. We're all so kind and gentle now. Well, I had a great time at LunCon. It was one of the best experiences I've ever had in fandom, and I'm very glad I was there, and I'm very glad I had a chance to hang out with both of you while I was there.
Likewise, on all counts.
Yes, absolutely.
So just before we go, before we wrap up this show, I'd love it if these two bloggers could just recommend a book that they're reading now or have read recently that that the listeners of The Rocket Talk should check out.
I've got two recommendations. The first is City of Stairs by Robert Jackson Bennett. I think it comes out next week or maybe the following week. It's the best book I've read this year. It doesn't do it justice to try to describe it now, but it... I think Justin will back me up here in that it'll probably end up on a few award ballots next year. It's secondary world fantasy, but with Robert Jackson Bennett's sort of twisted view on reality and I loved it. I can't stop thinking about it even months after I've read it. And my second recommendation is going back to our conversation about the Wheel of Time and how potentially some series in might end up on the Hugo ballot after they've all wrapped up. And one that I'll put on my ballot next year is Elizabeth Baer's The Eternal Sky trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
It begins with Range of Ghosts, and it's a beautiful epic fantasy set in a sort of Mongolian steppes-inspired setting that just from the first page of the first book to the final page of the third book just had me just took me over, and I couldn't stop reading until I put it down. It's a beautiful, beautiful trilogy, and I can't recommend it enough.
I've read both of those recommendations, and I would echo them with an exclamation point. Foz?
Well, I have been so caught up this past month that everything that I've been meaning to read for review has kind of fallen on me like a literal stack of books, which it is. On the plane to and from LunCon, I finally managed to read Sylvia Moreno-Garcia's collection of short stories, which has just come out, called This Strange Way of Dying. And that was a really quiet and beautiful and thought-provoking collection, which I do recommend. I'm going to be reviewing that for Strange Horizons. I'm also still in the middle of reading Cameron Hurley's new novel, which is The Mirror Empire, which is just big and colorful and feminist and angry and brilliant epic fantasy with all the things in it. And I'm not even finished with it yet, and my brain is just curling out in all of these new places to want to try and talk about it. But with stuff I actually have finished this year, and this is a book that I think will be on my awards slate for next year, is Catherine Addison's The Goblin Emperor, which everyone was talking about, which was just brilliant. Again, secondary world, but sort of steampunky with elves and monarchy and politics, and just really gorgeous. And I went back as a result of having read that, because she also writes as Sarah Minette, and I went back and read her Doctrine of Labyrinths quartet this year, which just completely crawled into my blood and just gave me all the feelings as books have not, as a series has not quite so, a new series has not quite so powerfully done to me since I was about 17. I have deep, deep feelings about the characters in those books. And the first book is Melusine. Highly recommend them. Highly recommend The Goblin Emperor, Mirror Empire, and The Strange Way of Dying. So that's sort of what I'm reading at the moment.
Goblin Emperor. You read it as well, right, Aiden?
I did, yeah. I love it. Everything Foz says about it, and Addison's writing is spectacular. It's unique in the field in that it sort of at its center is this idea of hope, which is a hard thing to find in a lot of secondary world fantasy. So,
yeah,
highly recommended.
I also loved it. Another exclamation point. I will just recommend The Incorruptibles by John Horner Jacobs. It's a Western secondary world fantasy, but very much a Western in the traditional idea of the American Western. It only is being released in the UK as of now, but it came out on August 14th, and it's fantastic. It's kind of like a buddy story, but sort of like some really screwed up buddies. And so it's kind of like Mark Twain meets the Western meets the epic fantasy. It's really cool. The Incorruptibles by John Horner Jacobs. So with that, this has been Rocket Talk, talking about Worldcon and all the good stuff. Thank you both so much for being here. I very much appreciate it.
No worries. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And this has been Rocket Talk.